Mr. Max, you've made an announcement seeking Virginia's 10th district seat earlier this year. The district where your grandfather, former Congressman Frank Wolf, used to represent it for more than 30 years. First of all, could you tell us what makes you decide to run for the seat in this year's election? What are your most important strengths among more than 10 other candidates in the primary?
Sure. Yeah, so I announced early this year. My grandfather, of course, had the district from 1980 all the way through 2014, so almost 34 years. He always says he rode Reagan's coattails in 1980. And, you know, it's funny, when he first got elected, we saw a lot of the same things happening in the world then that we now see today, whether it's the inflation, which is almost at 10%. It was, I believe, almost 15%. My granddad was running for Congress in 1980. We see Russia and the Soviet Union, like it was aggressive back then, and now Russia and Putin is aggressive again and trying to reconstitute the old Soviet Union. We're seeing extremely high gas prices and energy prices and lines at the grocery stores and food prices rising. These are all things that ushered and convinced my grandfather to run for Congress that he saw back in 1980. And then here we are in 2022, and we're seeing the same issues. And, you know, the reality is, you know, this is a tough seat. It's not going to be an easy seat to win. Jennifer Wexton is obviously an incumbent Democrat. But specifically for somebody my age, I'm 24 years old. I'll turn 25 in the summer, so before the election. For my generation, a lot of these issues that I just laid out, whether it's inflation, the energy, the wars going on around the world, are issues that my generation is going to have to face and tackle. And so my biggest thing is, anytime you see a problem, it's best to start on it today, not tomorrow. And so that's what led me to run. I'm worried about where our nation's headed.
This is a district that is turning more towards the Democrats. How could Republican candidates fight for a real chance?
We've still got ground to make up. We had almost 90-some percent Republican turnout in this district, and we still lost it. And so what that tells me is we've got to build the base. We've got to expand the party. And in my view, the best way for Republicans to do that, there's two ways. One, in the minority communities, whether it's the Muslim community, the Indian community, the Korean community, the Latino community, I mean, all of these communities, which this district, the 10th District of Virginia, the new 10th District, is a 45% minority district. So we've got a lot of first-generation Americans. A lot of people come from all over the world. And frankly, a lot of them are conservative in their leanings, whether it's their religion, their family values. The problem is we as Republicans very often don't reach out and invite them to our party. Ronald Reagan always said we need to be a big tent party. And I think we need to get back to that. So first, it's running over those first-generation Americans that understand the threat of a government gone awry. And then secondly, young people in the 10th District, we checked the math. People aged 18 to 25 in this district, the new 10th district, voted almost 92% Democratic in 2020. There's almost 50,000 Democratic voters for, you know, between that, those age groups, 18 and 25. And so I think a big thing for Republicans, not only in this district, but around the country, is how do we get and reach my generation, Gen Z, the tail end of the millennial generation? How do we bring them back over to the Republican Party? And this is an issue that, again, we've got to reconcile across the country. My opinion is we've got to be a party of vision, the future, give these people a solution. I mean, my generation has lived through 9/11, a pandemic, two recessions, right? Now we're seeing potentially a world war. We lived through the Afghanistan war. We have seen a lot of chaos. And so what is the Republican Party going to give our generation? What kind of vision are we going to paint for them for the future? And I think young people have to be a large part of that problem. And then lastly, I'll say this district also, it's basically a big district of suburbs. You've got, we've got a little bit of rural, we got a little bit of city type, but mostly it's suburbs. And the suburbs are going to be the battleground of the future for Democrats and Republicans. Outside major cities, suburb districts with high minority populations, that's where the House and Senate majorities will be won and lost in the future. And I hope to build a model for how we can win here across the country.
Your grandfather was a very accomplished congressman. Besides all the other achievements, Mr. Wolf's endeavor to human rights meant a lot to people in need for help, including in China. What kind of things are you aware of in this regard?
He was one of the only members of Congress during post Tiananmen Square to actually go and visit Tiananmen Square. He's been to Tibet. He went and met with the Dalai Lama. Especially right now, I believe we are seeing religious freedom come under attack in not only this country, but the entire world like we've never seen before. And the Uyghur genocide, I believe, is the most in-our-face example of this. In the millions of Uyghur Muslims systemically rounded up, I saw an article today about how they put them in these little prison cells with 40 men, and they have cameras, and they have to ask for permission to stand up and go to the bathroom. And Xi Jinping was quoted saying, it's like boiling frogs. At some point, the world forgets, or you forget about the frog in the pot, and it dies. They are going to eventually exterminate these people. And what did we say when we told the world never again after World War II will we allow this to happen? And we're letting it happen. And we're seeing the Buddhist monks that are burning themselves, right? What's happening in Tibet? It's cultural genocide in Tibet. And not to mention all different, again, the Coptic Christians are still being persecuted. Christians in Pakistan are still being persecuted. I mean, faith around the world, anti-Semitism is at an all-time high. It's a serious threat, and it's so fundamental to who we are as Americans, religious freedom, that if we don't take a firm stand from Congress to defend these people around the world, but also right here at home, then history is destined to repeat itself. And I believe China, whether it's persecuting the Catholics, which is happening in Hong Kong, or it's happening in Taiwan, I believe that. I was actually surprised. I used to tell people the day that Putin attacks Ukraine will be the day that Xi Jinping attacks Taiwan, and I genuinely believe that they would do that. I'm surprised they've waited as long as they have, but I think sometime in the next 2 years we'll see Xi Jinping and the Chinese government attempt to take Taiwan.
You've mentioned that China is steps away from attacking Taiwan. How could the U.S. help to prevent that from happening? And how would you evaluate the policies so far?
Now, I think if there's one thing we learned from Hong Kong, there's one thing we learned from the Ukraine situation, is that whatever we do after the action happens is usually too late. And so the best way that we can protect Taiwan is before the attack happens. And I actually read a recent piece in Foreign Policy magazine, and I have to check to make sure everything's true, but it was talking about how since Taiwan does not have the conscription anymore for the military, how in many respects that they are very understaffed. So they've got plenty of equipment and planes and tanks and guns, but not enough soldiers, which is very alarming to me. I think, Israel has been given a great example. They've got many countries around them who provide a great threat. And so the entire country has basically come together, and they have this military service that they have to do, and they train them very well, and they've become so strong militarily, even though they're a small country with not a lot of people, that nobody will touch them. I think that's what Taiwan must do. And so from an American foreign policy standpoint, making sure that we are encouraging them to build out their military, to train their troops, and let China know that if they move on Taiwan, that we will respond, whether it's making sure they have all the ammunition, that we support them economically, that we put in sanctions. But I think we must spell out precisely what we will do before it happens, so that way they know what we will do. But first, the best way to protect Taiwan is to make sure that their military is operating at peak performance. And I'm a fundamental believer why many people want in the United States want to go and help the Ukrainians is because they have proven that they're willing to fight for themselves. Zelensky, these guys are heroes. They are going in and saying, we will fight Russia alone if we have to, but we want the help. And when the world sees that, the world wants to help. So Taiwan's got to remember that the best way they protect themselves is to prove to the world, which I believe their president has done a good job of this, by saying, we will go it alone or we will do it with the United States. But we've got to make sure that their military is operating at peak performance, at full capacity, ready to act when it comes, because deterrence is always better than trying to take back the country. And with the semiconductors and everything else, I mean, Taiwan, really, even though they're a small country, they play a big role in the global economy that we cannot forget about either. And so encouraging these companies to make sure that they maybe even can open plants in America, stuff like that, we need to make sure that those avenues of communication and business stay open.
You founded the student-led Athena Institute and helped start the organization Stand Against Chinese Communism. Could you give us an introduction on the two organizations? What are their main goals and the impacts that they have made?
The Athena Institute, basically how this all happened, how it started is, I was a senior, I guess I was a junior at George Mason University right here in Fairfax County, and I transferred from a smaller school to go to George Mason to study American government, and on my first day of classes, I was walking around looking for my classroom, and I walked past a room which had a Chinese Communist Party flag on the wall and all this Mandarin writing, and I thought, what is this? I was confused. And so a few weeks later, when I had some time, I came back and I investigated, and it was a Confucius Institute. And it, actually, the George Mason Confucius Institute was the Confucius Institute U.S. Center. So it was actually basically like the main headquarters for all of the Confucius Institutes in the entire country. And so when I found out about that, I did some reading and found out, I mean, it's propaganda, right? It's teaching, a washed history of what happened in China. They won't talk about Tiananmen Square. They'll never talk about what's happening to the Uyghurs or any of the people being persecuted. And it's really an arm of Chinese soft power, which we've seen, they have a whole bunch of soft power all across the country and the world, but the Confucius Institutes were specifically, targeted at college students. And so I thought, how crazy is this that we have a Confucius Institute at George Mason University? And I did some digging. The largest population of Uyghur Americans in the entire country is in Fairfax County. So I said, well, let's do a letter to the president and say, hey, we don't want Chinese influence on our college campus. When we started, there was about 125 Confucius Institutes in the country. Since our letter and Athenae's founding, Athenae was basically founded to make sure that when the university said they would close their Confucius Institute, that they actually did. Since we've started, over 100 have closed, and some have been for other people, some we had direct hands, but it was basically to give the universities the cover that students were in favor of kicking China off campuses. And what's so crazy, I think, about the Confucius Institute is there was $100 million that would come from the Han Bond to fund the Confucius Institute. The deal that they signed with universities, and this was the case at George Mason, is that half the money that went to fund the Confucius Institute on campus had to come from the college. So that means that some of my hard-earned dollars, some of this tuition dollars that the Uyghur students on campus were paying to George Mason University, was being used to fund propaganda for the Chinese Communist Party. And do you think that Xi Jinping or Beijing or the Communist Party would let us open Abraham Lincoln Institutes or Ronald Reagan Institutes in Shanghai? They would never let us do it. They'd be like, no, you can't do that. But we let them come here and do it to us. And this goes back to a broader China is they hope their soft power will influence people all around the world, where it's the Belt and Road Initiative, the Sister City Programs, the Confucius Institutes. This is all Chinese soft power. And I'm all for teaching Chinese culture. I'm all for Chinese students coming and learning here in the United States. The Chinese people are wonderful people. They're amazing people. They're persecuted. The Communist Party is small. The Chinese country is huge. We need to encourage all of that, but not the history that the Communist Party wants to teach us. And so that's where Athenae came out of. And then SACC, Standing Against Chinese Communism, is our political action committee, C4, that basically puts out surveys to state delegates and governors and attorney generals when they're in their election season to say, hey, when I get into office, I pledge to combat Chinese influence at the state level. And that's really where a lot of the threat of the Chinese is on the state level, because they know it's very hard to infiltrate congressmen and senators. But sometimes it's a little easier to do this with mayors and town councilmen or attorney generals. And so we are trying to get people all across the country to agree that they will not cut deals with the Communist Party.
We wish you the best in the campaign. If the result is less than ideal, what's your plan for the next?
First, I'm going to help whoever beats me in this primary. It's about 10 people in the primary. They're all nice people. So I'll help whoever it is beat Jennifer Wexton in the fall. But secondly, my Athenae Institute, the nonprofit that does the human rights work, our big kickoff, our next big push is going to be divestment from university endowments from the Chinese Communist Party, specifically around the Uyghur genocide. So we've already got about 5 universities that have agreed to do audits of their endowments. We just did a national letter signed by Michael McCall, Nikki Haley, Keith Kroc, the DocuSign founder and former Undersecretary of State, who actually was the highest ranking government official to ever visit Taiwan. He's on our advisory board. And so that letter's already gone out, and that's our next big push at the nonprofit. And so I'm going to go, and I would go work full-time with them to make sure we're still advocating and doing all that work. And we've got our big kickoff for that planned for June 2nd. So if I lose, then that'll be my next thing.